Okay, moving right along, we have Sheena Heineman. She's going to, her talk is entitled Studying the Remix and Its Effects on the Consumption of Music. Sheena is a PhD candidate at York University. Her dissertation explores the concept of remixing through the lens of media ecology and considers the way in which remixing is possible for changes in the production and consumption of popular music.
Thank you. Thank you for being here today. This afternoon, I'm going to talk a little bit about a concept that I've been working on in conjunction with my dissertation called reordered listening. I define reordered listening as the act of hearing music out of order by coming into contact with versions of songs prior to encountering the original song upon which the version is based. A necessary precondition of reordered listening is that the listener will not have heard the original song before coming across a variation of the original. Though it's possible to experience reordered listening as a consequence of hearing cover songs, renditions of popular pieces of Western art music, jingles and commercial adaptations, and so on, reordered listening happens most often as a result of exposure to remixed music. Remixing is a type of composition common to electronic dance music in which the composer, usually referred to as a producer, uses an existing recording in combination with newly composed musical material in order to create a new version of a piece of recorded music. Remixes and remix analogs, such as re-edits, bootlegs, and mashups, have become increasingly more commonplace over the last decade, fueled by a combination of affordable digital music-making technologies, an increase in online music consumption, a subsequent decline in profits for the music industry, and the cumulative increase in the number of record labels who use remix as a way to cheaply market new releases to customers. Moreover, the experience of reordered listening frequently occurs incidentally rather than purposely, with remixes appearing in a wide variety of settings, such as on mainstream radio, in television commercials and shows, and in urban public places like shops and restaurants. As encounters with remix music have begun to occur more regularly, there's been a corresponding shift in both music consumption patterns and attitudes towards the remix as an artistic endeavor. That is, audiences are becoming more likely to both enjoy and seek out the work of remixers upon experiencing reordered listening, often without being compelled to search for the original song, which is ostensibly the intended purpose for the release of remixes by record labels. In this presentation, I'll discuss how reordered listening occurs in conjunction with the ubiquity of the remix. I consider how reordered encounters with remixes affect patterns of consumption and how audience attitudes about the value of remix as compared to the original song have begun to transform. This paper is based on findings from ethnographic fieldwork performed between March and November of 2011. During this time, I conducted interviews with 82 respondents who represent the categories of DJ and producer, music blogger, non-musician audience member, and record label. In many, and sometimes all of these cases, there was significant overlap between these categories. For example, a producer of remixes is also necessarily a consumer of music. Further, many producers form their own record labels as a means of maintaining control over their creative output, and these record labels often maintain eponymous blogs in order to keep fans apprised of new releases and tour dates. In contacting members of the music industry, I relied on the internet and used SoundCloud, an online online music distribution platform, The Hype Machine, a music blog aggregator, and the contact information provided by record labels on their websites to reach out to these respondents. With respect to non-musician audience members, I used a technique called snowball sampling in order to seek the broadest sample possible given the time constraints of my study. I began by reaching out to my friends and acquaintances via email and Facebook, and then requested that they reach out to the people in their own social networks. Importantly, I chose not to limit my discussion to audiences whose primary means of consuming remixes occurs on the dance floor. As a result, a wide range of ages, geographies, and musical preferences are represented in my sample. Finally, 9 out of the 14 respondents representing record labels did not self-identify as DJs, producers, or music bloggers, and thus were not included in the survey about personal consumption habits. Therefore, the results presented in this paper are based on responses of 73 out of the 82 respondents involved in this study. This paper will focus on two questions posed during the interviews, which aim to get at the heart of consumption patterns and attitudes that result from reordered listening. The first question is designed to better understand the process of music consumption after an encounter with an unfamiliar remix by focusing on the next logical step in a sequence of consumption. In other words, does hearing the remix compel people to further explore the original song, the source of inspiration for the remix, or are audiences more likely to pursue the discovery of more music by the remixer? In order to determine the effects of reordered listening, respondents were asked to answer this question. You're out and about and you hear a song that you like, and later you discover that the song is a remix. You've never heard the original version of the song before. What are you most likely to do next? Are you most likely to seek out the original song, or are you most likely to seek out more music by the remixer? Respondents then chose one of three options: to find the original song and artist, to follow the work by the remixer, or some combination of both. The first option listed in this question is to seek out the original song, and 18 of 73 respondents claimed that this would be the most likely path to choose. Interviewees who would choose to seek out the original song over works by the remixer did so for a variety of reasons. Common responses include wanting to compare the original and the remix in order to get a sense of the differences between the two, desire to know the source material that's based on a preference for non-electronic styles of popular music, a preference for physical media over digital media, and as a way to help listeners make more informed decisions about what they would prefer to listen to in the future. While these responses generally indicate a lack of prejudice against forms of electronic music, there were also those whose choice to seek the original song following an encounter with a remix were driven by a bias against electronic music, or the idea that remixing represents unoriginal expression. For example, Duncan, whose remark you can see here is on the last in this list, chooses to seek the original song over the remix as a consequence of pre-existing negative assumptions about the quality of remixed music. Quote, I'd probably have to start by going to the original song, because I think people who remix songs, their work is often hit or miss. Sometimes, you know, if you've got a whole album of remixes, you're only going to get one or two that catches your ear. I mean, I'd probably go to the original composer, artist, just because that's where the remix comes from, end quote. The language used by the respondent reveals a bias against remixing for reasons that appear related to opinions about how to define authenticity and what it means to be an artist. While remixers are referred to merely as people, those responsible for the original work are called composers and artists. Further, Duncan seems to discount the fact that many albums of original work also contain only one or two songs that will catch the attention of audiences. Although the intended purpose of many remixes is to lead the listener to the original song, 23 out of 73 respondents argued that following the remixer's work would be the most logical next step if they enjoyed the remix itself. The most commonly offered reason as to why this is the case was an enjoyment of the aesthetic of the remix. In other words, if a listener deems the remix good, it's assumed that the remixer will probably have more music that appeals to their taste than will the original artist or the original song. Many respondents also commented on the fact that the remixer's aesthetic is more prominent in a remix than is the original artist's, and a propensity to consume music through the internet and a preference for electronic music, the primary milieu for remixing, were also cited as reasons for choosing to seek more music by a remixer as a result of reordered listening. Another reason offered by respondents who would choose to seek the music of a remixer was the inability to know where and how to find the original song. I found this to be a particularly interesting response for two reasons. First, remixes as a general rule are labeled as such and will include the name of the original song, the original artist, and the remixer. As you can see here in this example, This is typical of how to label remixes. The song title appears first, the remixer's name is in parentheses, and then the song is then attributed to the original artist. However, it's definitely not always clear by the way a song is labeled that it's a remix, even when the listener suspects that this might be the case. For example, Serbian producer Gramofonzi has a tendency to alter the titles of the original source material that he uses for his remixes rather than explicitly identify the song as a remix in the title. Secondly, and ironically, a lack of knowledge about where to find information about remixers and remixes was also cited by respondents, whose most likely course of action is to seek the original song instead of other examples of a remixer's work. In both cases, the question of how to access information about a remix seems mostly to reinforce existing taste preferences. People who don't regularly listen to electronic music are less likely to know where information about remixers can be found, while those who do regularly consume electronic music might be less concerned about finding information about a remix's source material when it's not readily available. Despite the general preference of fans of electronic music to seek out remixes of original songs, there remains a glaring exception to this rule. Those involved in the music industry in any capacity are much more likely to equivocate and claim no preference for either the original or the remix. Instead, both songs would be sought equally, or the decision of which to pursue following a reordered listening event would be determined on a case-by-case basis. In total, 31 respondents argued that hearing a remix they enjoyed would send them searching for both the original song and more music by the remixer, and the bulk of this group is made up of DJs, producers, and music bloggers, with non-musician audience members being relatively poorly represented in this group. It was common for DJs and producers and bloggers to cite their position as industry insiders as the reason to seek both versions equally. Beyond insider status, the reasons to pursue the discovery of both paths are often determined by the qualities of the remix itself. For example, Ben, a 44-year-old respondent from Los Angeles, argues that, quote, "It depends on what I like about the original song, so I've definitely sought out the original before when I've thought, wow, that song is amazing, particularly if it's got lyrics and vocals. But sometimes I really like the song structure or the way they break down the instrumental or those kinds of things, in which case I will seek out more by the remixer." End quote. Like Ben, one-third of respondents who argue that the next step could only be determined on a case-by-case basis qualified their response by suggesting that the presence of singing and lyrics in a remix would be more likely to lead them back to the original song. By contrast, remixes that don't feature singing would cause them to focus more on the presumptive skill of the remixer, thus leading them to seek more from the remixing producer. And beyond reasons of musicality, respondents who claimed that they would seek both the original song and more music by the remixer argued that their decisions were informed by a curiosity or because they trust the people in the music industry to shape popular representations of musical taste. The second question that I want to focus on here deals with the importance of the order of listening. On this score, respondents were asked the following question. When you hear a remixed version of a song before you're exposed to the original, how do you typically react when you do finally hear the original song? In other words, what effect does hearing the remix first have on your evaluation of the original song when you do finally hear it? This question was meant to help to determine the extent to which the order that songs are listened to governs perspectives about the original remix dichotomy and subsequent opinions about a song's perceived originality. Responses to this question were subdivided into three broad categories. First are the more objective responses, where the listener claims to be uninfluenced by the knowledge that a song is derivative or the order of listening. This perspective was represented by the smallest number of people, only 10 of 73 respondents, and were much more likely to be articulated by DJs, producers, and bloggers, many of whom argued that their roles as music industry gatekeepers necessitates a more objective approach to the evaluation of music. A second category of listeners, and by far the most populous, represented by slightly fewer than half of respondents at 36 of 73, gave what I've characterized as subjective responses to this question. The respondents in this group were less likely to be involved in the music industry and were more likely to make comments about personal preference rather than offering insight on how these preferences are informed by the order in which they hear songs. The third type of response, offered by 25 out of 73 respondents, came from those who linked perception of preference with the order of listening and how this can influence their opinions about remixing and derivative music. For numerous respondents in this latter group, reordered listening results in a kind of transference of signification insofar as the first version of a song that they hear tends to become the authoritative version in the minds of the listeners, regardless of whether or not the first version is the original version. While almost every person who answered this question did mention that hearing two versions of any song would naturally cause them to compare and contrast, it's usually the case that the original version is considered the standard bearer against which the remix is judged. When the remix becomes the initial point of comparison, it usurps the original version's position as this standard bearer. For example, one respondent remarked that the version of a song she hears second, whether an original song or a remix, lacks what she called the first-time enjoyment factor that she associates with the first version she hears. While another respondent notes that, quote, it's just purely chronological at that point. If I've heard the remix first, at some level, my brain thinks that's more original, even though it's not. End quote. In other words, the experience of reordered listening can challenge our perceptions of what is considered unique simply by reversing the order in which we typically hear original songs and their variations. Another effect of reordered listening is that it can cause listeners to soften their judgments about the perceived value of derivative music. It will probably not come as a surprise to anyone that a bulk of the criticisms leveled at remix music tend to be expressed as a disapproval of its derivativeness, which is frequently considered to be inauthentic and unoriginal. For example, some argue that hearing remixes of songs prior to hearing the original version of any song is tantamount to theft because listeners lose the opportunity to contextualize their judgments of the remix against the original song. Implicit in such comments is the fear that reordered listening will result in the impoverishment of perceptions of the original song in favor of the remix, and indeed many respondents did argue that this was often the case. As one person remarked, quote, instead of judging the remix, I'm judging the original, end quote. And another comments that, quote, I don't really compare them. I think when I do hear the remix first, I think of them as two different pieces of music, like two different entities. Whereas if I were to hear the original first, the remix is something derivative, end quote. DJ and producer Juan McLean offers some insight as to why this might be the case, arguing that the contextualization of remix music against a previous listening experience with the original song is more likely to result in a negative opinion about the remix's derivativeness, whereas no such bias exists when the remix is heard before the original song. Quote, if I hear the original first, then I have this sort of context that involves sort of structural things, melodic things, rhythmic things, that I can judge the remix against. And by the time I've added it all up, it tends not to seem as good as the original. But when I've just heard the remix first, you're not thinking of it that way. It's just easier to evaluate it as its own track, end quote. In other words, it's much easier to appraise a remix on its own merits when there is no other basis for comparison. This, in combination with the knowledge that the second version heard is actually the original version, causes listeners to maintain a certain level of distance between the original version and the remix, increasing the likelihood that the remix will be assessed as an entity separate from its source material and increasingly as a more original contribution to popular music. In this presentation, I've argued that reordered listening, which occurs as a consequence of the pervasiveness of the remix, results in changes to expected consumption patterns, as well as causing listeners to question firmly entrenched attitudes towards derivativeness and originality, which have become less rigid and somewhat more fluid as the remix has become a more visible feature of the cultural landscape. Though I hesitate to call my conclusions preliminary, it's clear to me that the patterns I discovered will benefit from more large-scale and long-term study, especially as remix and other styles of derivative composition become significantly more mainstreamed. I plan to continue my research in this area beyond my doctoral degree, and in the meantime, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions about the ways in which to measure the impact of reordered listening on the consumption habits of audiences. Thank you. Questions? Yes. Oh, okay. That's one type of remixing, and that's probably the most literal use of the word, and it's used in recording practice, basically, where you have a bunch of tracks and you adjust them so that they sound a certain way. In electronic music, a remix is a song that is composed using parts of an existing recording in combination with newly composed material, and this creates a new song that is it's called a remix of an existing song. And there's lots of different types of remixes, and this is one of my big criticisms of existing literature on the topic of remix is that they kind of confuse people by not differentiating between remixes and analogs, such as bootlegs and re-edits and mashups, which are, they're different insofar as they're informed by different logics. They have different processes that define their existence, basically. So Unfortunately, I don't have any examples with me today because I didn't bring my computer, but I have an iPod full of remixes if anyone is interested in listening to some afterwards. Yes?
Why is it called remix? It seems like it's sampling, isn't
it? That's a very good question, and one that I don't know the answer to. I think you can probably trace it back to the origins of remixing. Well, and there's two main places where people find the origins. But the first is in dub music, and the second is in disco. And in dub, originally remixing started out as after World War II ended, and the American soldiers left all their music and their PA systems and stuff, and all that. Dub producers would equalize the recordings that they had to isolate parts, and then they would recombine them or take some parts away so that the MC could toast over top. So that's an early precursor to remixing. And in disco, early remixing was actually what's called today re-editing, where they would take the existing recording and instead of adding new parts, they would just extend instrumental parts to make the songs longer and more appropriate for the dance floor. So that's likely the origin of the term. I agree with you, it's very much akin to sampling. I think the big difference though between contemporary remixing and sampling is that sample-based music tends to use samples from a lot of different recordings. Remixing uses one recording with new composed musical material. Yes. Yes. Hello.
Are the remixes pretty much contemporary with the original versions?
They are, especially as I mentioned, remixing is being used by the music industry as promotional material. So a record label will commission, 5 to 10 remixes of different styles, and then they'll distribute them to music blogs for free or online distribution platforms like SoundCloud as a method of enticing people back to purchase the original mix. So in that respect, yes, they are often very contemporary, but there's also a movement towards using remixes to reinvigorate older styles of music. Probably the most well-known example of this is the Verve Remixed series, where Verve Records commissioned a bunch of producers to remix their catalog, and they've released so far 6 volumes, I believe, of jazz standards remixed in a contemporary style. And it's very fascinating, actually, how dated these have started to sound. The very first album of Verve Remixed was released in 2002, and electronic music, because of the advances in technology, it's kind of changed at a fairly fast clip. So these songs sound very kind of cheesy nowadays, but when they were first released, they sounded very contemporary and forward-thinking. And they, as a matter of fact, the most recent volume of Verve Remixed was released just last summer, and it was in association with the video game L.A. Noir, and it was called L.A. Noir Remixed, if anyone is interested in checking that out. Yes?
Well, it's curious that they're commissioning the record company's commissioning remixes to push purchase of the original, but your research is showing that that's not an effect at all.
That's true. And as I mentioned in the conclusion, I really think that these effects are going to become more pronounced within the next 5 years or so, because it's quite prevalent that record companies are doing this. And in media ecology, we call this an unintended consequence. What I think is going to start happening, and this is another part of my dissertation, is the financial structure of the music industry is changing. We all know this. And copyright sort of limits and often prohibits people from receiving remuneration for their derivative works because they're not considered original expressions legally. But I spoke to many producers in my fieldwork who are beginning to receive publishing and licensing contracts for their remixes and not just for their original songs. And actually, I learned a great story that I wasn't allowed to write about because there's a publication ban on this story. But I can tell you guys because you're not going to write about it. English producer Rory Phillips was hired to do a remix for a band called Yacht, and they never signed any contracts, though Roy Phillips apparently tried very hard to get them to commit to a publishing and licensing contract. This remix was then used in a car commercial, and it made Yacht a lot of money, and so Roy Phillips sued the band and won the lawsuit. They settled out of court for an undisclosed amount, and because they settled out of court, the part of the publication ban was that nobody knows this except for me, because I spoke to a producer who was a friend of Roy Phillips, and then I confirmed later with Roy Phillips when he told me that I wasn't allowed to write about it. So,
nice.
Yes, sir.
So, in question one, you referenced the original composition or the original artist, and then you used the word remix.
Yes.
So, in remixes, you take the song, the original song, but then the artist, the person who does the remix, who actually is an artist, adds original composition on top of that.
That's right.
Might the question have primed a negative response as a remixer by taking away the thought that they are, in fact, an original artist themselves?
That's a very good question, actually. It's entirely possible. I accept that there are almost certainly flaws in my methodology. So that's entirely possible, but I think it's also important to acknowledge that calling them composers is also not correct. Not because they're not composers, and not because they're not artists, but just because they don't think of themselves that way. It's very common for DJs and producers to say, I'm not a musician, I'm a DJ. It's, in their minds, it's a separate thing, and it belongs to a separate part of musical culture, and I think it's important to respect that. And remixing is highly regarded in the electronic music community as a way for remixers or for young producers to break onto the scene, to get noticed, to achieve some kind of early fame, or to just, practice producing electronic music using really good available material and kind of reimagining it in the way that they would prefer to do it. So your point is well taken, and I think that's definitely something that I should add to my dissertation. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Where that it's a song that you've heard over and over again, and all of a sudden you find a remix. Well, how do they remix it? And there is actually a couple of CDs I'm very familiar with of Beatles songs.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody's familiar with the Beatles songs. You listen to these remixes, and sometimes they even have notes as to what the remixing techniques are for each of the songs as it proceeds through.
Yes.
And the other thing, I've been a catalog for many, 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 many years, and you deal with name authorities. And so when you are cataloging a recording, and you do have the subject heading remixes as an accepted subject heading, with the Library of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
You use that, you can refer to that. But when you're dealing with name authorities and remixers' names, they change their name depending on the kind of music they're remixing many times.
That is absolutely correct, yes.
Who is this person? What is their real name? There's a great website, Discogs.com.
Mm-hmm.
You're familiar with
yes.
Discogs. You find a lot of this work done, mm-hmm. which is really great. They give you the list of all the pseudonyms of all these remixers, as well as all the artists on all these albums.
It's very interesting that you bring that up, because I read a recently published article, and this article was just published, I think, in April, and I think it's in Popular Music and Society, if anyone is interested in checking it out, David Gunkel, and he makes the argument that remixing cannot be considered authentic original expression, one of the reasons being that remixers use pseudonyms, and therefore they are not offering their identities, and therefore they can't be given credit for that work. To which I say, how can you make the argument using a band like the Rolling Stones as an example, and then say that a remixer who uses a pseudonym cannot claim ownership over his own work? What makes the Rolling Stones not a pseudonym? In fact, it's a collective, so there are more people sharing the credit. The idea that you can't give people credit for their work because they use a pseudonym is just ridiculous to me. So I'm really glad that you brought that up.
Are you familiar with the group Negative Land?
Yes.
The letter 2, then the letter U, and the number 2, and
Great record.
A Great,
great record.
With Casey Kasem and his off-air remarks. That's wonderful remixing of not only the song by you two, but also Casey Kasem, you know, in spoken word portions of it also.
Mm-hmm. Yes. There was a question over here, and then I'll get to you, sir. Yes.
Do the remixers, given the trouble the rappers got into with sampling, do the remixers get permission to use this?
Yes.
How much of an issue is that in the remixers?
It certainly is still an issue, but again, because record labels are so intent to produce a lot of music at the lowest cost, they're more likely to give permission when it's sought, or they'll do something like they'll host a remix contest where they'll release the stems, and producers will download them and create remixes and submit them, and then the winners of this competition will be you know, they'll be given some kind of token prize, like a lump sum or a release on this record label with the possibility of maybe making money in the future with a speculative contract or something like that. So yes, there is an increasing number of young producers who are obtaining permission, and very easily, but it is also the case that producers continue to make remixes illegally, and in those cases they're usually from existing recordings that have been equalized to separate the parts, and those are called bootlegs in electronic dance music, and those are more often than not only used for personal use. They're not released commercially or rarely over the internet as well, because you can run into problems with lawsuits and such. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did that have a negative impact on sampling and remixing to the point where, what kind of impact did that have? Because obviously, that went a lot of people.
You know, I.
So they got no money at all on that record. It all went to Alan Klein.
That's I couldn't comment on that, unfortunately, because that's well beyond my wheelhouse. I don't actually deal with copyright very much, but I imagine that one of the effects would be to just make producers more careful about obtaining permission, or just about if they don't obtain permission, then not trying to release it commercially. I think one of Verve's big problems there, just based on your description of this lawsuit, of which I have no familiarity, is that they released an album commercially and tried to make money from it. What young producers are doing now, as I just mentioned, is they're creating bootlegs, and then they just use them in the clubs, and they don't give them to anybody except for maybe their DJ friends. And if it ends up on the internet, it's not to make money, and then it's usually shut down pretty quickly, and that's the end of it. So. Thank you.